From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the hostage negotiator who was taken hostage. Terry Waite represented the Church of England when he was negotiating for the release of Western hostages. It was shortly after the Arms for Hostages story broke that Waite was captured. Although Waite said he knew nothing of the deal, it may have compromised him in the eyes of his Lebanese captors. Last month, Oliver North admitted that Waite was used by the U.S. We'll talk with Waite about how he was used and about his 4 years in solitary confinement. Also, commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about William Blake, Witness Against the Beast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Jurors in the Reginald Denny beating case arrived at their final verdict today. They found defendant Damian Williams not guilty of attempted murder. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
Damian Williams hugged his attorneys and smiled broadly when he heard the verdict read. The mother of co-defendant Henry Watson cried out loud when the judge declared a mistrial on the final count against him, assault with a deadly weapon against another truck driver. On that charge, the jury couldn't break a deadlock. Watson is already being processed out of jail. The six-month sentence he still faces for a misdemeanor assault conviction is considerably less than the year and a half he's already spent in jail. Damian Williams now faces a maximum 8-year sentence for his single felony conviction, mayhem, for causing permanent damage to truck driver Reginald Denny. The verdicts are a major victory for the defense and have generated both joy and anger here. Many in Los Angeles' black community felt the defendants had been overcharged. Others are incensed that those they believe responsible for the violence they saw on videos of the riots got off so easily. At the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse, I'm Renee Montaigne.
Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole says he'll back off on an amendment that would limit the president's authority to send American troops to Haiti or Bosnia. The agreement came after 3 days of negotiations over Dole's effort to prohibit the spending of defense funds for military operations in the two countries without the approval of Congress. As part of the agreement, President Clinton sent a letter to Dole saying that he'd welcome congressional authorization of any military involvement in Bosnia. Leaders of 12 Somali factions have announced that they'll boycott any peace talks where Mohamed Farah Aidid is present. NPR's Michael Scholar reports these leaders feel threatened by the new U.S. overtures to Aidid.
The 12 political groups represent all the opponents of Aidid, and for the last few months, they were the ones with UN and U.S. support, while Aidid was isolated and hunted. Now, these factions, known as the Group of 12, feel Aidid has gotten the upper hand. He can claim he beat the U.S. and is now being courted for peace talks. Mohamed Kanyari Afras spoke for the group.
So Aidid benefits to kill Americans. He benefits to kill Pakistan. He benefits to kill Nigerians. The violence has good results.
The group says Aidid cannot be trusted, so they will not negotiate with him, only with his representatives. And they warn they will start the civil war again if Aidid is given power in a new government. This is Michael Scholar in Mogadishu.
On Wall Street today, the NASDAQ index lost a half point to close at 768 and a quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points to close at 3,645. This is NPR News. The relative quiet of the ceasefire in Mogadishu was broken today when two American Black Hawk helicopters were fired upon with rocket-propelled grenades. The two attacks came in separate incidents as the helicopters patrolled over southern Mogadishu before dawn. UN officials said they believed the incidents were isolated and not a sign that the ceasefire appears likely to break down. One of the airports serving Paris has been completely shut down by striking Air France employees. The protests have disrupted travel plans for thousands of passengers and inflicted heavy losses on Air France and other carriers. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
About 200 Air France employees are blocking the runways at the Orly Airport south of Paris, forcing all carriers to halt flights. There's also a protest going on at the Charles de Gaulle Airport north of the capital. That strike is only affecting Air France, which has canceled about 500 flights. The workers plan to continue their protest. Next week, they'll be joined by employees of Air Inter, France's internal carrier. The strikers are protesting a plan by Air France to slash 4,000 jobs and wages. Air France said it will go ahead with the plan anyway. The company lost about $500 million in 1992, and it's expected to lose twice that much this year. The transport minister told workers that the strike is hurting the company's finances even more. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
President Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations has outlined the administration's ground rules for committing troops to international peacekeeping missions. Ambassador Madeleine Albright told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that U.S. troops would remain under the president's command and usually play a limited combat role. She also said that American vital interests must be at stake. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terry Waite was negotiating for the release of Western hostages in Lebanon in January of 1987, when he was taken hostage himself. He was held for nearly 5 years. 4 of them were spent in solitary confinement. Waite had been the Archbishop of Canterbury's special envoy to Beirut, authorized by the Church of England to work on behalf of the hostages. Waite was given partial credit for the release of Father Martin Jenko, Reverend Benjamin Weir, and David Jacobson. But after the Iran-Contra scandal broke, questions were raised about whether Waite knowingly or unknowingly played a role in the Arms for Hostages deal, since he had worked with Oliver North. Waite addresses that in his new autobiography, Taken on Trust. He says he first heard about the Arms for Hostages deal in 1986, when he was with the just-released hostage, David Jacobson, in Wiesbaden.
Well, my reaction was one of very great shock, because that was the first time that I had any indication at all that type of dealing had taken place. And the first thing I did was to get up and go to the communication room and ring Oliver North using the White House switchboard. And I asked him what the substance of this was. And there was very little comment from him. He simply said, well, everything will be all right. And I put the phone down, and I knew in my inner being that everything would not be all right. It seemed to me an extremely serious matter, if it was true, as it later turned out to be true.
Now, you had been working with North in the sense that you had met with him, spoken with him, and even traveled with him. So you had no idea that he was negotiating arms for hostages.
Absolutely no idea at all. It's not unusual that I should have met Oliver North. I mean, he was the person appointed by the American administration to deal with the whole question of hostages. I mean, he had his counterpart in the United Kingdom, in Israel, in all countries, really, France, that were associated in this matter. The reason, I think, or there were a number of reasons why he wouldn't tell me and didn't tell me about this matter, and why he wanted to keep on to me, because I was the only person to have a face-to-face meeting with the kidnappers in the Lebanon, in Beirut. And he knew very well that if I had heard about arms trading, then I would have walked away, partly because of my own personal reasons, I don't agree with that, and partly because I could never involve the church in such matters.
Last month you met with Oliver North for the first time since the 1980s. What did he tell you?
Well, we met in a house in London, and I asked him directly, was I used? And his response was, yes, you were used. The American government uses people all the time, which is a very straightforward response. Didn't particularly please me. It doesn't necessarily surprise me, because unfortunately in politics, as we well know, these things happen. I saw him, as I was discussing with him, in two ways, really. One, as a functionary of the American administration, as a military man. The question I didn't ask him, which on reflection I might have asked him, but he may not have answered it for me, was, were your actions self-authorized, or were you acting under orders? And if so, who was giving you your orders? My suspicions are that he may well have acted in certain respects in a self-authorized way, but I strongly suspect he was acting under orders. In that whole arms business, it would be too much, much too much for one man to pull off in the way that it was claimed.
So North told you that you were being used by the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. How do you think you were being used?
Well, I think in the following way. It's very interesting that the first two prisoners to be released were clergymen, Ben Weir and Martin Jenko, the Roman Catholic and the Presbyterian. They, kidnappers told me that they were releasing these men as a sign to the church, to keep the church involved and to encourage us in our efforts. Now, unknown to me, there was the overarching political alliance, so it seems now, arms for hostages, between Iran and the United States. And it seems now, and this one can only know with hindsight, that as I was working on the Lebanese agenda, that provided a cover for the broader political dealing to take place between Iran and America in arms for hostages.
So when the arms were really responsible for hostage releases, the public could think, well, it's Terry White's negotiating behind it?
In part, but not totally, because this. I am not sure, and I cannot prove this, but I am not sure at that time just how much the Lebanese knew about Iran arms for hostages. I mean, they were clearly working on their agenda, which was concerning Kuwait. Iran had a relationship, undoubtedly, with Hezbollah in the Lebanon, and were in some means controlling, in some means financing and supporting the radical Shiite movement in Lebanon. But how much Iran told the local kidnappers of their broader political intent, arms for hostages, I don't know. I suspect they didn't know for quite some time.
In the Tower report, a memo from Oliver North was printed describing you as, quote, our only access to events in Lebanon. Do you think that you were used in an inappropriate way to get information to the Americans?
I don't think I was used inappropriately there at all. Before going to the Lebanon, I met with Oliver North in his capacity as the person to deal with the hostages from the American administration. And he asked me to ask certain questions of the kidnappers, which I did. And they knew from the very start that I was in touch with the American administration. They also knew that I was going to go back to America and give their answers clearly at the highest level. In fact, I went back to the United States and went to the White House and met with the then Vice President, George Bush, and gave the response of the kidnappers to the questions that had been put.
So everything was in the open there, no subterfuge?
There was no subterfuge at all there. The kidnappers knew of my contact with America. I mean, there was no reason to keep it secret because there was that communication between the administration and the kidnappers. Through me, of course, they weren't directly talking to them. And Oliver North is quite right. I was the person, and I believe the only person, who had a direct face-to-face meeting with the kidnappers on several occasions.
So how do you feel about Oliver North now? And do you think that he betrayed you?
As we sat down for that interview in London, I would see him in two ways. One, as a functionary of the administration, probably acting under orders. And two, as a human being. I suspect that he was mortified, or at least very surprised, when I decided that to go back after the whole political initiative that he seemed to be engineering collapsed. I don't think he expected me to go back at all. And when I sat down with him, I could see in his face some degree of remorse there. And I said to him, as a human being, one human being to another, well, I don't directly hold you responsible for my going back. I said you left me no chance, no alternative. And he agreed that he'd left me no alternative.
Now, what do you mean by that? Why was there no alternative? Why did you feel you had no choice but to go back to Lebanon?
For two reasons, principally. One, my integrity as an individual certainly had been called into question as had the integrity of the church. There was absolutely no way that I should or could or would involve the church in arms dealing, and no way that I would be consciously involved in that myself. So, one, integrity had been compromised. Two, I knew that the hostages were demoralized by the political collapse of the contra-affair, that whole business. They were demoralized by that. It seemed to me to be entirely wrong if, when the going got really difficult, I, as a representative of the church, should pull away from them and say, I'm sorry, it's too difficult now.
Terry Waite is my guest. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Terry Waite is my guest. He's written a new autobiography called Taken on Trust. Why do you think you were kidnapped and taken hostage?
I have to give you a little bit of a story again. I went back on that last journey and went to see my principal contact with the kidnappers. He said to me, Terry Anderson and Tom Sutherland are very depressed. They're ill. We even think that they may die. I mean, we have to remember, of course, as I recount this story, that this is real life. This is not a novel. This is for real, and hostages did die. I said, I'm sorry to hear that. He said, the last time you were here, you asked to see them. We didn't allow you then, but we'll allow you now. I said, you'll keep me. He said, no. I asked him to give me his word on his faith that he would not.
That he would not keep you and hold you hostage.
Correct. And he gave me his hand and gave me his word. I said, I need time to think about that. And I went away, left him, and went away to think about it for 24 hours. The advice I received was this, that if a man gives you his word on his faith, he should not keep you. And that is strictly true. I still had my reservations. I knew that the risk was very high. But I had to say to myself that if there is a chance that he's telling me the truth, and if I walk away from people who are in that desperate situation, then I've got to live with my conscience for the rest of my life. There's a certain selfish motive there, I suppose, but that's how I felt. And so I went and found myself kidnapped. I think they kidnapped me because, in some measure, there was a degree of puzzlement, I think, in the Lebanese as to what had happened and what my involvement was with the whole Contra affair. They wanted to question me about that. They possibly wanted me out of the way, and they possibly thought that as the game was up, so to speak, everything had broken politically, I would then not necessarily be much use to them, and therefore they might as well take me, see what I knew, and use me as a pawn in the game.
When did you realize that something was wrong?
Well, I mean, I had my suspicions all along. I mean, I suppose the first indication was when, in the doctor's surgery, the telephone rang and the doctor said that he had to leave and go and to attend to a case at the hospital. I asked him to stay until my contact with the kidnappers came, but he declined and went away, and I was left alone in the surgery. And
no, which doctor was this?
This is Dr. Marawi, who was someone who I don't think was necessarily sinisterly implicated. I think he was simply used as a person to provide a meeting point for me and the kidnappers. And a doctor's surgery in which people come in and out is not a bad place to meet. He went away, and the kidnapper came, and I went with him. And as expected, I mean, there have been rumours, of course, that, and ridiculous rumours, because anyone who knows this situation would never believe them for one moment, that I was carrying a locator device. What people don't realise is that when you go for a meeting such as that, you have a complete change of clothing. Every tooth is examined to see if there are any locator devices there.
And the rumor you're referring to is that there'd been a rumor that for Oliver North, who were carrying a tracer device so that they could locate where the hostages were through your location.
Quite. Totally untrue.
But you had a completely change of clothes.
Complete change of clothes. Every scar in the body probed.
Mm-hmm.
And had anything been found, I wouldn't be talking to you today. Then, as expected, I moved from place to place, but that would be normal procedure because in case we were being followed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found myself eventually in a tiled cell underground. And I realized that my status had definitely changed from being, hopefully being a negotiator to being a hostage myself.
Now, the person who gave you his word on faith and then broke it, did you ever see him again?
Yes, several times. On one occasion, he was a person who, for a period of time, took part in the interrogation of me. And I reminded him at one point, in the company of others, that he had given me his word. And he leant over and whispered in my ear and said, "Never, ever say that again. Never." And I said, "Very well, that's a matter for you and your conscience, and it's a matter for me and my conscience, and I know where I stand."
Had you mentally prepared yourself for the possibility of becoming a hostage?
Not really. No, I can't say that I really had. But preparation began almost immediately. I found myself in that small cell because then I said, well, goodness knows what's going to come. I wasn't at all sure as to whether I'd be allowed to live. But I said three things to myself, and they sound rather pompous now, but they were said in order to give me something to hold on to. I said, no regrets, no self-pity, and no over-sentimentality, because nothing to regret. I'd done my best. Self-pity kills, and over-sentimentality, you drown in it.
Was it easy to keep those three resolutions?
No, it was difficult. Because you can soon find yourself slipping down. But when I did slip down, I tried to bring myself back to them and hold on to them, and they proved to be pretty useful over the years.
How often were you interrogated while you were held hostage?
Well, interrogation took place spasmodically over the first 9 to 10 months, maybe a year. And that was accompanied by a beating on the soles of the feet. For the first 9 months or so, I was chained hand and feet and left blindfolded lying on the floor with no exercise at all, nothing. No books, no papers, no nothing at all, no radio. And then just simply woken up in the nights and interrogated. After that, when that was over, there was a mock execution also. I mean, that was the very end of the interrogation process. And after that, when they were quite convinced, I'm sure quite convinced, that I was straight up, that ill treatment, that form of ill treatment, discontinued, and thereafter conditions improved somewhat. I mean, then I was only chained by the feet, but still in a dark room and still denied companionship for the whole of 4 years.
What did your interrogators want to know?
They simply wanted to know what I knew, what had passed between us. They asked me to write the story of my life, for example, and things of that nature, and then they asked me specific questions about North. And as I had nothing and no knowledge of his dealings in the Iran business, I was in the very fortunate position of being able to answer truthfully.
Now, you write in your book about how you were beaten on the soles of your feet during some of the interrogations, and you referred to your mock execution. You were told during one of the last interrogations, or perhaps the last one, that you had 5 hours to live unless you told them everything.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel pretty confident you'd be dead within 5 hours?
I remember that very distinctly. A man came into the room and he said, or two men came in, they said, you have 5 hours to live. And I thought that they were for real, yes. And they left, they said, you think what you're going to tell us because these are your last hours. And to be quite honest, I was so emotionally exhausted at that point that I simply said a prayer and then lay down and fell asleep. And I slept for virtually the whole of those 5 hours.
Did you ever think, well, maybe I should just make something up just to keep them happy so they don't take my life?
No. And I said to myself, I said, I am just not going to. I'm not a particularly brave person at all. I'm not in any way an extraordinary person. But I did say to myself on that occasion, I am not going to plead for my life. If you take my life, that is for your conscience, not for me. I'm not going to plead. And I just wouldn't. So I had to hold on to some human dignity in those extreme circumstances.
They told you could write your final letter. How did you compose it?
Well, I asked to write several letters because I wanted to write one to my boss, if you like, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Obviously, I wanted to write to my wife and children and friends and mother. But they wouldn't allow me to write several letters. They'd only allow me to write one, so they said. So I had to write an extraordinary letter to the Archbishop, and I addressed it to Archbishop first because I regarded myself as being there on his mission, if you like, and I felt if I put his name first, then it would stand a chance of getting out. It never actually did get out. And then I addressed it to my wife and children and mother and one or two personal friends and relatives. And I simply said that I'm sorry to leave you like this, but I'd like you to know that I'm in good health and good heart. And don't think too hard about the people who've done this, because they too have suffered much in their lives. The words to that effect.
Kind of good-hearted final note, considering you were about to be executed, you thought.
Well, yes, I did. And, well, you might as well finish, if you've got a last letter, you might as well finish on a sentiment which you can hold to, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, during the mock execution, when the captor actually put the gun to your head, did you think, this is it? I mean, what went through your mind and what you thought was your final moment?
I'd read in novels of people experiencing fear and their throat going dry. That certainly happened to me. I mean, my throat went completely dry.
So that you couldn't swallow?
Absolutely. It was terrible. They asked me if I wanted a drink, and I asked for a cup of tea, which is a good British custom. And they brought me a cup of tea. And then I did the letter. And then I said a prayer. And they allowed me to say that. Then they said, face the wall. And I was blindfolded, of course. So I turned around to face the wall, and I felt the gun at my temple. And it was held there for a moment, and then it was dropped. And the man said, another time. And that was that.
So was your feeling afterwards gratitude, thank God I'm still alive, or were you almost sorry that you still had to face the captivity and face what could have still been imminent death?
I was glad to be alive, although I have to say that at that point I was afraid of the way in which I'd die. I mean, I said, what will you do with my body? And they said, well, we'll leave your possessions at the British Embassy and we'll drop your body in the Mediterranean. I felt terrific misery, you know, for my family, because having met many hostage families in my life, I know what it's like. And I thought, yeah, they'll never know how I lived in these last days and how I died. I felt terrible about that.
Terry Waite's new autobiography is called Taken on Trust. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Waite will be back with us in the second half of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Terry Waite. He represented the Church of England when he was negotiating for the release of hostages in Lebanon, then taken hostage himself. We'll hear about his 4 years in solitary confinement, during which he was interrogated, tortured, and subjected to a mock execution. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about poet William Blake called Witness Against the Beast by the late British historian E.P. Thompson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton and Senate Republican leader Robert Dole have reached agreement on presidential authority to send U.S. troops overseas, thus averting a showdown over the question. Dole agreed to soften resolutions to curb Mr. Clinton's ability to send U.S. troops to Bosnia and Haiti, and the president said that he would welcome congressional authorization. This comes after 3 days of negotiating over Dole's original plan to bar funding for U.S. military operations in the two countries unless Mr. Clinton had the approval of Congress. In Bosnia, Serbian forces have allowed a U.N. aid convoy to reach a Muslim area in the northern part of the nation. Aid workers say if Serbs continue to cooperate, many lives will be saved this winter. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
The convoy was the first to reach the besieged town of Tesanje for 5 months. Several recent attempts to pass through the northern Bosnian Serb stronghold of Banja Luka had been denied. Another convoy will try to get into nearby Maglaj on Thursday. Between the two towns, there are thought to be 40,000 trapped people. Some are even reported to have been killed by airdrops of food. Meanwhile, UN officials have denounced as disgraceful the treatment of Muslims in Serb-held Banja Luka. They said Muslims were being terrorized until they begged to be moved from the town, but then they had to pay an extortionate price before they were allowed to leave. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
At a meeting in Germany, NATO defense ministers have offered prospects of higher-level cooperation with the new democracies in Eastern Europe, but they held back on possibilities of immediate membership. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
At the meeting in Travemünde in northern Germany, the 15 NATO defense ministers agreed more military cooperation was necessary with the Eastern European countries, including Russia. But no decision was made on the controversial issue of opening up NATO membership to these countries. Germany has been pushing for closer ties, but U.S. officials have expressed stark reservations. Poland in particular has been pressing to join NATO, but officials have postponed a decision due to concerns the membership of Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary would isolate Russia. At the meeting in Travemünde, U.S. Defense Secretary Les Aspin warned of the dangers of proliferation of nuclear weapons, especially from the former Soviet Union. The defense minister set up a working commission to investigate solutions. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In London, several thousand people took part in a demonstration outside of Parliament calling on the government to change its mind on a plan to impose value-added taxes on home heating fuel. Protesters charged that the tax is unfair and falls more heavily on people with lower incomes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 10 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has warned China that it has to make progress in human rights, trade, and arms control in order to gain extension of most favored nation trade status. Christopher said at present China's record is a mixed one, with some discouraging pieces of news. China's trade status was renewed in June for one more year on condition that there is overall progress in areas that are now doubtful. A consumer group is accusing fast food restaurants of misleading the public about how they prepare foods such as French fries, donuts, and fried chicken. NPR's Joe Palca has more on the story.
The Center for Science in the Public Interest says fast food giants like McDonald's and Burger King did the right thing by switching away from animal fat for frying food. Animal fat is bad for blood cholesterol. But the consumer group says the fast food outlets aren't accurate when they say their foods are cooked in 100% vegetable oil. In fact, the group says, most fast food chains use vegetable oil that's been hydrogenated, a process that makes the oil last longer and easier to ship. But hydrogenation also makes it higher in something called trans fatty acid. Recent research suggests trans fatty acids may also be bad for blood cholesterol. Although cutting down on trans fatty acid may be a good idea, most nutritionists agree a better idea is to cut down on fried foods altogether. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
In Somalia, U.S. helicopters were fired upon early this morning in areas controlled by forces loyal to fugitive factional leader General Adid. Meanwhile, another factional leader has warned that the country may go back to civil war if the U.N. does not control Adid's forces, whom he charged are continuing to fight. U.N. officials say that they believe these latest attacks are isolated and are not a sign that a unilateral ceasefire is about to break down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Terry Waite. In his new autobiography, Taken on Trust, he writes about his efforts on behalf of the Church of England to negotiate the release of Western hostages in Lebanon, and how in 1987 he was taken hostage himself and held for 5 years. You've spent the first 4 years of your captivity in solitary confinement. That's a hell of a long time to be in solitary confinement. What were some of the ways that you found to keep your mind intact?
To keep my mind intact, what I did was begin to write in my head, and the book that you've mentioned is the book I wrote in my head during those years.
And we're talking about your new autobiography, Taken on Trust.
Yeah. In a sense, you know, it is, you can call it an autobiography, but it is, in a sense, more of an account of survival with autobiographical recollection, and I'll explain what I mean by that. The first chapter, I take the reader by the hand, almost, and we walk together to the last meeting with the kidnappers. The second chapter goes right back to very early memories of childhood. And the reason for that is the process, that is the psychological process that took place. And I think, as I now reflect on it, why I was doing that was to try and find security that was lacking in the situation of imprisonment. Try and find a golden age, you know, when the sun shone and the hedges were green and one could walk along country lanes holding mother's hand and try and find that security. And yet, when I went back to childhood, I found that there were insecurities there. In other words, there was no golden age, and one has to learn to grow up and reconcile inner conflict, inner turmoil. And so what I try to do is trace this experience, trace this psychological, spiritual progression across life, and relate it to the experience, day-to-day experience, of plodding on through solitary. And it was a way of keeping sane, certainly.
And since you were using memory almost as a mental exercise while you were held hostage, did you develop ways of remembering things that you had no idea you could remember?
Very much so. I mean, I found, for example, in terms of people I'd known came back from across the years with extraordinary clarity. And yet, you know, they're brought into the book in a rather shadowy way. For example, my family don't figure large in the book. And one of the reasons for that is because of the emotional pain of bringing people into the experience. I mean, for now, I understand for the first time in my life why it is that many long-term prisoners say, after a number of years in captivity, to their families, they say to their families, don't come and see me again. It's not because they don't care. It's because they find it too painful. They care too much, almost. And that's how it is recorded in the book. The psychological process is that you figures come and they appear almost like shadows and then they go again. And certain people who are perhaps more distant, you fill out a little bit more, but you're still in solitary and you're still battling with yourself and your identity and survival. And then the other thing, of course, improving of memory, I mean, I did a lot of other things. I mean, retreat into fantasy. I wrote novels in my head, which have yet to see the light of day. And did a lot of mental arithmetic, some mental arithmetic, just simple stuff that was meant memorizing long strings of numbers, and sometimes that would last for 2 or 3 days.
Terry Waite is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Terry Waite is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called Taken on Trust. Do you feel that you were any better equipped to handle the experience of being a hostage because you'd spoken to people who had been held hostage? You knew something about the experience. You knew something about how they had managed to survive it. Was that of any use to you?
I think of very small use, really. There's such a world of difference between theoretical knowledge and practical knowledge. So certain things, I mean, I anticipated and expected, such as the chaining and the blindfold and all that. I mean, all the things that hostages had told me previously. But you can't really appreciate it until you've been through the experience, really, and I don't think there's very much that can prepare you for that experience. I mean, some people say how remarkable and how extraordinary and what a remarkable example all it is. But I actually don't think myself that the suffering of the hostages is greater than other human suffering. I think it's surrounded by extraordinary events which give it a drama and heighten it. But the family who see a child die from cancer, or the couple who experience broken relationships, or numerous things one could mention across life. Human suffering is human suffering. What I try and say in my experience and record in the book is that suffering need not destroy. It is possible in many cases, if not all, but in many cases, to make something creative from what could be a destructive experience.
After your 4 years in solitary, you were moved to share a cell with Terry Anderson, Tom Sutherland, and John McCarthy, who it turns out had been right across the wall for you for some time. In fact, you were communicating with them for a while through a Morse code tapped onto the wall. But you say you had trouble adjusting when you moved to their cell, that having company brought both relief and apprehension. What were the difficulties of being in the company of others after 4 years of solitary?
Well, precisely this, that I had to learn how to survive alone. And as I already said a moment or two ago, that leads to a certain self-centeredness, if you like, because you just have to be like that. They had, in Terry Anderson's case, 7 years with other people, chained up, learning to survive together. Now, as I had established a pattern alone, they had established a communal pattern, a very different pattern of relationships. And I moved into their company in very cramped circumstances, just 7 inches between each bed, or each mattress. There was no bed, just a mattress on the floor. And I moved in at a point where I was extremely ill. I developed a very severe bronchial infection, which meant that my constant coughing and wheezing day and night was very disturbing to them. So not only did we have to find new patterns of communicating, they had to put up with someone who was very sick. And indeed, Terry Anderson has since told me that he thought that I was going to die. And in one sense, you see, a sick man coming into a room, they think he's at the point of death. My death threatened them with their survival, too. So you have a lot of unconscious factors operating there.
Now, these were the men who you had been coming to save. You wanted to negotiate their release. Now you were being held hostage with them. Was there much discussion of that, acknowledgement of that?
We didn't have a lot of discussion about that at all, no. Partly because, I think, we were conscious of our discussions would be listened to. And for a long, long period of time, when we were together, not only were we chained to the wall, there was actually a camera, a video camera, in the room recording our movements and a microphone recording our conversations. So, you know, those are inhibitions. You never know how they're going to be used or how they're going to be doctored or changed or used against you. So there is a degree of care one needs to exercise in that sort of situation.
Did you want or do you feel that you received any unspoken gratitude for your efforts?
I think as a human being, yes, one would appreciate that. And it has been said by Terry. Terry has mentioned that. But I think there's another thing, another unconscious factor operative here. And it's this, that I'm not sure how conscious some of the others were of this. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think there was a feeling also of almost embarrassment or guilt on their part when I was moved in with them, that in a sense they'd signed the letter, or at least some of them had signed the letter, asking me to go out there to help them. And there I was now along with them. In a sense, they probably felt a little responsible for that, which made, again, things difficult. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily conscious, and maybe that would be even consciously denied. But it's something, the reason I mention it, it's something that's been discussed subsequently in the rehabilitation that we've all been through as we've come out of this experience.
When you look at your decision now in retrospect, your decision to go to Lebanon after the revelation about the Iran-Contra affair, to go back to Lebanon to try to negotiate the release of the hostages, what do you think about your decision to do that? Do you think you did the right thing? It's always hard to say what you would do if you had it to do over again, but I'll ask it anyways. If you had it to do over again, would you do it?
I do believe that that was a testing point in my life, which comes to many people when they have to say, or have to answer the question, do you really believe what you have been saying? In other words, you have said in the past, have faith. You have said in the past, do your best for people. Are you able to put that into practice? Now, I have to confess that if I look across my life, I haven't always done the right thing. I don't suppose anybody has. But I knew very well that I had to put my feet where my words were and go that last journey. And I have absolutely no regrets about doing that. Whether or not I'd be able, I have the courage to do it again, I don't know. But it is one thing I did right in my life. I did, on that occasion, stand by what I believe. I wish I'd done it all my life. I haven't.
The Robert Runcie, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, who you worked with, was quoted as saying that he thought it was your lack of sophistication about what was being worked on you by the Americans and your love of publicity that was the cause of your difficulties. Is that a harsh judgment?
Yes, it's a harsh judgment. And there'll be many harsh judgments made. It is sometimes difficult for me to appreciate how judgments can be made about my motives when I've had a lifetime struggling to try and understand them. They can't be made so simplistically by anybody from outside. I can understand why he might say that. But it's not... I can understand, in a sense, someone making the accusation about publicity up to the point where the going got really difficult, really tough. Then publicity isn't worth a candle because it's your life on the line. And lack of sophistication... Yes, I think partially true there. There has to be a certain amount of naivety in any individual if he's going to exercise any trust in anybody else. I calculated as best I could. I knew I was taking a risk. And I'd rather, even now, particularly now, sooner have a trusting nature than have a mean, suspicious nature.
Now that your autobiography is written, what kind of work will you be doing?
I asked myself in captivity that very question. If ever I get out of here, what would I like to do?
Probably not negotiate for hostages anymore, right?
No, not necessarily. I said three things. Read more.
Yeah.
Which I was, actually I'm doing. write more, and I shall continue to write. This is just but the first book. There'll be others. And continue to engage in humanitarian activities, which I've done. I mean, I do a lot of work with prisoners. I work with an agency in England called Victim Support, which is a group that helps victims of violent crime. I have interest in overseas development. And as for hostages, I mean, I don't have any need to prove myself. I don't need to do that. I don't need to say, oh, well, I haven't lost the old touch. I don't need any of that. But all I can say is, if ever there was a situation in which there was a contribution I could make that could not be made by others, I hope I'd have enough spirit to say, okay, I'll give it a try.
One last question. While you were in captivity, you write that your dreams were rich and wonderful, as if to compensate for the life of deprivation that you were leading. Now that you're a free man, is your life in prison being replayed in your dreams?
No, it isn't. No, interestingly enough, it isn't. And I think by writing the book, or by committing the book to paper, because it was written years ago in some ways, but by committing it to paper, in some ways, that has contained the experience or dealt with it. I don't believe that any of us who have painful experiences in our lives, and we all do to a greater or lesser extent, should blot them out. It's a matter of somehow taking them and recognizing them and allowing them to be used creatively. That is possible in most instances, not every, but in most instances. And I think that's happened, and therefore it doesn't haunt. It loses its power to haunt.
Terry Wade, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Terry Wade's new autobiography is called Taken on Trust. This is Fresh Air. The Reginald Denny beating trial ended today. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on the trial on All Things Considered?
We'll have a piece from Renee Montaigne, Terry, who's been covering this long trial for us, on how this one came out and what happens next. There will be more trials. Some of the defendants in this case were separated and will have separate trials. We'll also talk about what happens now in Los Angeles. Does it leave the city more racially divided than it was? Are tensions higher or not? We'll also talk to a young person from Long Island, one of those communities where a young man was hurt from lying in the middle of the road in imitation of a movie.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the early 1980s, a poll was taken in Great Britain to determine who were the most admired people in the kingdom. When the ballots were counted, the top three winners were Queen Elizabeth, Margaret Thatcher, and E.P. Thompson. Thompson was known as one of England's foremost historians and social critics, but it was his leadership role in the British nuclear disarmament movement that brought him popular acclaim. Over the past two decades, there were rumors that Thompson was writing a book on the poet William Blake. E.P. Thompson died this past August, and his Blake book, called Witness Against the Beast, has just been published posthumously. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Back when I was an earnest undergraduate, I took a voluntary tutorial in the poetry of William Blake. Once a week, a few other lost souls and I would meet with the professor and try to unravel the poetic hairballs of Blake's prophecies, like the Four Zoas and America. I always remembered that professor's parting words on the day the tutorial ended. "Don't worry anymore about Blake," he said. "Blake's a lunatic." Well, that's one theory, but it leaves a lot unexplained, like the radiant power of Blake's engravings and the glimmerings of bitter social criticism you can spot in easier poems like the Songs of Innocence and Experience. So I was thrilled when I heard E.P. Thompson's book on Blake was finally out. I'd read Thompson's first book on William Morris, so I knew he had an affinity for utopian thinkers. I also knew from Thompson's monumental book, The Making of the English Working Class, that he was a great stylist with an intimate knowledge of 18th and 19th century English social history. If anybody could plant Blake in the real world, Thompson could. This past weekend, with my cable TV on the blink and my answering machine on the alert, I transported myself, with Thompson's help, into Blake's London. And when I finished Witness Against the Beast, I had learned one crucial thing. By our standards, William Blake was indeed a lunatic, but so were many of his contemporaries. As Thompson describes it, 18th century London was weirder than any place David Lynch could ever dream up. On virtually every corner, storefront mystics hawked their own popular forms of Christianity. There were Anabaptists, ranters, Brownists, Adamnists, Seekers, and the Children of the New Birth. Some of these beyond-the-fringe congregations worshipped in the nude. Others preached the gospel of free love. These are the kind of people Thompson recognized as history's losers, the people he was always determined to save from what he called the enormous condescension of posterity. Thompson's aim here is to show how Blake's mind was formed by this dissenting Christian tradition and by one mysterious sect in particular, the Muggletonians. The Muggletonians met in London pubs where they sang divine songs, denounced reason as a satanic principle, and forged a politics hostile to the emerging market economy. Thompson breaks with generations of Blake scholars when he claims that Blake owes as much to the Muggletonians as he does to Milton. And Thompson warns us that if we continue to embalm Blake in an academic mortuary, we don't have a prayer of understanding his work. I won't mislead you. Witness Against the Beast is accessible, but it's also scholarly. You won't enjoy it unless you already care about Blake or you're curious about 18th century dissenting religions. But Thompson implies that one of our most serious mistakes as modern readers is that we only want to know about the familiar. Anything we can't familiarize, we label bad or bizarre. Like Blake, E.P. Thompson also bore witness against the bestiality of his age. In his last book, Thompson once again retrieves from the embers of history's fire the strange, the subversive, and the sublime.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Witness Against the Beast by E.P. Thompson. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Devin Reif. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, providing abortions in rural America in spite of the death threats. We talk with Dr. Susan Wickland, who performs abortions in Bozeman, Montana, and Fargo, North Dakota. Also, we'll talk about computer communities with Howard Rheingold. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.